Mr. Baker, as you know, the conferees of the House and the Senate agreed on a tax increase bill at about 2 o'clock this morning. If that should pass the two houses of Congress, when do you think the budget deficit will be below $100 billion?
Well, George, our estimate, of course, of the deficit for fiscal 1983 is $115 billion. And that presupposes that the budget resolution will be fully implemented. That is, that the tax bill will pass and that the spending cuts, which are called for in the budget resolution, will pass. The further projections by the administration would indicate that you would be below $100 billion deficit in fiscal 1984. I think the number is $94 billion and moving down to $60 billion in 1985.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with White House Chief of Staff James Baker. Mr. Baker will be questioned by CBS News White House correspondent Bill Plant, by Lou Cannon, White House correspondent for the Washington Post, and by the moderator, CBS News correspondent George Herman. We shall resume the interview in a moment. But first, here is George Herman.
James A. Baker, the third of that name, was born into Houston's well-to-do legal community where his grandfather had helped to found a major law firm. His family was strongly allied with the Democratic Party, but sometime shortly after the death of his father, young James Baker III switched to the Republican side. Like his family before him, Baker was sent to a New England prep school, then on to Princeton and the law school of the University of Texas. Once he had passed his bar examinations, young Baker joined a Houston law firm. Not the old family firm, which had a rule against too much family in one office, but a similar prestigious Houston firm. Then he practiced law for 18 years. During that period, he met a friendly young fellow Houstonian named George Bush. They were assigned together as tennis partners. Baker was still a Democrat then, although he says he was really apolitical. And in 1970, his good friend George Bush asked him to manage Bush's Senate race. Says Baker with a grin, "I couldn't very well do that as a Democrat." But the truth seems to be that his first wife had been working for some time to convert Baker, and the time was then ripe. In 1972, Baker ran as the Republican candidate for Texas Attorney General, and he lost the election. He served as state Republican finance chairman, and in 1975, he was brought to Washington by Interior Secretary Rogers Morton to be Morton's undersecretary. In 1976, Baker headed President Gerald Ford's twin campaigns, first against Ronald Reagan for the nomination, then against Jimmy Carter for the election. In 1980, he went back to work for tennis partner George Bush, heading Bush's presidential campaign, and then, after the conventions, turning his considerable loyalty to the service of the nominee, Ronald Reagan. Baker's first wife died, leaving him a widower with four sons. He subsequently married a widow with three children, and they had a daughter, making altogether a family of eight children from 4 to 27 years old.
And now we continue with Face the Nation.
Mr. Baker, I'm going to suggest that your first answer, and I verge a little bit on the edge of rudeness here, that your first answer was a little bit disingenuous when you quoted those budget deficits, because Mr. Stockman, who is presumably responsible for some of them, agreed that they might be $20 billion more than the figures you just named. The Congressional Budget Office and Chairman Volcker of the Federal Reserve Board think the deficits will be $140 to $160 billion through 1985. What I want to know is not the official figure which was issued with some doubts, but when you personally think the deficit may be below $100 billion.
Well, George, the official figure, of course, is what I gave you, and I recognize that there are differences of opinion with respect to that. I think the point is that these ballooning deficits that we see are the reason why it is very important that the Congress implement the budget resolution that's before it, and this is the reason why it's very important that we have a tax bill and that tax bill pass the Congress. Now, it's really not important when I personally think the deficit might be below $100 billion. In first place, I'm not an economist, and I really don't have any independent view of that. The important thing, I think, is that we need to constantly keep our eye on the fact that deficits are a major problem in this country, that The ever-expanding size of these deficits keeps interest rates up, and the fact that interest rates are remaining too high is what prevents the recovery from taking place. So it's very important, we think, as an administration, that we do some responsible surgery, if you will, with respect to these deficits.
Mr. Baker, the president and other administration spokesmen have been blaming these ballooning deficits, as you call them, on the Democratic Congress and on Democratic policies. Now you're relying on Democratic votes to pass your tax bill. How can you go out in the country and ask people to elect a Republican Congress based on that?
Well, we can ask people to elect a Republican Congress, Lou, because it's important that the president have a Congress that will work closely with him 90-95% of the time. Had we not controlled the Senate this last year and a half, much of the legislation that has been passed, historic legislation, if you will, the most sweeping changes in fiscal policy in 30 or 40 years, would never have been passed.
Yeah, but that goes right to the heart of Lou's question. If you're going to rely on the Democrats to pass it, how can you go out and campaign for the Republicans, particularly in those districts where you got Democratic votes?
Well,
it turns the whole thing on its head.
There are many instances, I think, where presidents have had to rely on bipartisan support to get their programs passed, and they have no problem going out and campaigning for their party or for their candidates.
Well, let me take you back to the opening question about the tax bill. Frankly, do you have enough Democrats to pass the tax bill? You can't do it with Republicans.
It's going to require bipartisan support, and I really
more than that, you have so few Republicans that you really need strong Democratic support.
It will require strong Democratic support, and I can't sit here this morning and tell you that we have that. We have those votes. This is going to be a very, very difficult battle. It's very much uphill. We think we're making some progress. We hope and believe that when the vote comes later this week, Thursday or Friday this week, that we'll have a majority in both houses.
Will you get more than 80 Republicans in the House?
I can't tell you that we'll get more than 80. It's going to be a target that we'll shoot at somewhere between 75 and 90. And I simply can't sit here and tell you we'll get more than 80.
If this bill is an important building block of the recovery program, as the president calls it in his television ads, why are you having so much trouble getting a majority of Republicans to support it?
Because, Lou, there's a legitimate disagreement within the party with respect to the bill and the necessity for the bill. The president happens to think it's important to the country economically, but he recognizes that others within his party disagree, and they disagree on principle, and he doesn't question the sincerity of their disagreement. The fact of the matter is, though, we have simply got to do something about these ever-ballooning deficits, and we've got to do something about high interest rates. And the bottom line, if you will, is with this bill particularly, is are we going to require those people who are not now paying their fair share to pay their fair share of taxes? Or are we going to accept the alternative, which is bigger deficits, higher interest rates, and continued high unemployment? That is an unacceptable alternative.
But the essence of Reaganomics was lowering taxes to stimulate investment and bring the economy
Absolutely.
Up from the bottom.
Absolutely.
Now the president has turned on that.
No, that's not true.
Why isn't it true, Bill?
The essence of Reaganomics is lowering taxes, and the president, even with the passage of this bill, will have given the American people over 3 years the largest tax cut in history, $306 billion. That's number one. Number two, this bill is basically a tax reform bill, much more than it is a tax increase bill. The new taxes in this bill represent only 17% of the entire amount, about $17 billion. And you're going to have $15 to $17 billion in spending cuts in this very tax bill. So the president has not departed from his philosophy. He still, in the first 18 months of his term, will have given the American people the largest tax decrease in history. This bill has been mischaracterized, I think, as the largest tax increase in history. It's no such thing, as the president pointed out yesterday.
Mr. Baker, like you, I'm not an economist, but it does strike me a little odd to have you say in one sentence that the deficits are ballooning out of all restraint, and boasting in the next breath about cutting $306 billion in revenues. Is there no relationship between cutting $306 in revenues and having the deficits grow?
Sure, there's some relationship between that, but the fact of the matter is, George, that the president's program has really not started to work. And the program is based on the idea that you cut taxes in order to generate productivity, savings, investment. That will generate a moving economy, which in turn will increase revenues. Now, we haven't, the program's only been in effect since last October, and we have not had time to see those revenues increase yet.
When do you think this program's going to start to work?
Well, we've said all along that we thought you might see the first signs of it in the second quarter of this year. We saw some signs that indicated it might be beginning to work in the second quarter of this year. I think it's very significant that in the course of the past month, we've seen the prime interest rate decrease by two full percentage points.
And unemployment go up by 10%.
0.3%. No, 9.8.
It's now the largest, I don't want to be argumentative, but it's now the largest unemployment rate in this country since World War II. Do you think that means that the program's working?
I think that unemployment is the lagging indicator in any recovery, and I think you would agree with me that that's the case. The point is, everyone knows that interest rates are the number one problem in preventing the recovery from taking place. Now, the point I'm making is you've had the prime go down two full points in 1 month. You've had money market rates go down 4 percentage points in a month, so that the T-bill rate now is something under 9%. That is very significant. And again, we think that if we do not show fiscal discipline, if the Congress does not implement the budget resolution by passing this tax reform bill and by passing the spending cuts that are required in the resolution, you're likely to see those interest rates turn right back around and shoot right up through the roof and totally abort any chance for recovery.
Nonetheless, for more than a year, recovery has always been just around the corner. To borrow a terrible phrase, it's always a few months further down the line.
I would disagree with that, Bill. I think when the president came in, he said, look, this is a problem that took 30 years to make,
and
I'm not going to cure it overnight.
And now he acknowledges that it's going to take even longer.
Well, I think he does acknowledge that the recovery did not come as soon as we had hoped, nor as strongly as we had hoped. I think that's a fair statement. I think the president's candid and forthright and frank in saying that. We'd hoped, quite frankly, we'd be seeing a little bit more of a recovery about this time. That doesn't mean that we're going to abandon the program, that we don't think the program is going to ultimately work, or that we're going to walk away from it.
Can you in all candor say that you won't be back next year seeking even deeper cuts in spending?
I would think that if we followed the president's program to its logical conclusion, we would be looking for additional cuts next year in spending. The president wants to continue to reduce the rate of growth of federal spending.
Fine. Where will they come from? Defense? Entitlements?
Well, we'd have to take a look at that time and see. We don't know where they would come
from. Almost
about
Social
left.
Security cuts. You're not ruling those out, are you?
We are ruling those out, and at this time, you bet your life.
But you're not ruling them out next year, are you?
We are ruling them out as of this moment, because the president has appointed an independent commission to study the problems with respect to the solvency of the Social Security system. That commission is going to bring in a report, and until it reports, we're not speculating or guessing as to what that report might contain.
You've only got two major areas in which you can cut further in any significant fashion without gutting the rest of the federal government, and those are defense and entitlements. The biggest chunk of entitlements, Social Security. You can say that you have to wait for the report of the commission if you want, but the fact remains, doesn't it, that if you're going to take any large chunks out of the federal budget from here on out, it has to be in entitlements, therefore probably Social Security, and defense. Yes?
I don't think we have to say that, and I think that we reserve the right, as we have, as any administration would, to take a look in the normal budget cycle at what the budget should be and where you would further reduce federal spending.
But just to underline Bill's question, you've seen the figures, and we've all seen them, that the way the budget is heading, if you leave military spending, you leave entitlements, and you leave interest on the federal debt where they are, if there were no other expenditures in the government, the budget would be in deficit. Military entitlements, transfer payments, whatever you want to call them, in interest. If there were no other government expenditures...
Assuming what sort of growth?
Assuming, I guess, the growth that's in the budget projections that you have issued.
There would still be a deficit,
but it wouldn't be the kinds of deficits we're now looking at.
But I'm just trying to underline Bill's question and say that those three items alone, which he suggests you may have to cut, would put the budget in deficit if there were nothing else in the budget.
That's correct.
Well, then don't you have to cut then?
Well, we have to take a look at the full range of programs that can be cut. And those three items, excluding Social Security, because the president is committed not to reduce the benefits of Social Security recipients.
Well, you asked what the economic projections are. Mine aren't important. What's important are is your projections. Are we now in a recovery?
I think the recession is bottoming out. I can't sit here and tell you we're in a recovery period now. We did say that there would be, and we still do say, that there will be a recovery in the second half of this year. The second half of this year is only 6 weeks old.
Will unemployment go higher?
I think we believe our economists tell us that unemployment is about reached its maximum.
Mr. Baker, what policy changes were discussed? We're told that there were policy changes in our policy toward the Middle East discussed in a meeting yesterday at Camp David with Secretary Schultz and other foreign policy advisors. What sorts of changes are we contemplating making?
Bill, I can't comment on that, on the specifics of that meeting. I think that the President and the Secretary of State met, as they have periodically since George Shultz was confirmed, to go over what happens in the Middle East after there's a resolution of the Beirut.
Is there a change?
Now, beyond saying that, I can't
comment. Is there a change in the tenor of the U.S. relationship with Israel?
No, I don't think there's a... there's not a change in the fundamental relationship. You say, is there a change in the tenor?
That's not fundamental.
The president indicated in his by his telephone call to Prime Minister Begin that there might be a little bit of a change in the tenor, but there's no change in the fundamental basis of the relationship.
How optimistic are you now that this latest development in the Middle East will produce the kind of settlement that you want?
We're reasonably optimistic. That's more optimistic than cautiously optimistic. But we're optimistic.
We think the
ceasefire is holding. We hope and believe that it will hold. And Ambassador Habib, as you probably know, is meeting at this very moment with Israeli officials, trying to iron out the last details of an agreement on the withdrawal of the PLO.
To pursue Bill's question just a little further, the statement that the White House issued said the president was shocked. The president was outraged. That's a change in tenor?
That's a change in tenor, I think, yes. Although the private communications in the past have been rather strongly worded. They haven't been made public. This one was made public. But I think that because it was made public, that's a change in tenor. At least that's the way I interpret it.
This one, which was made public, has resulted so far in a fairly stable ceasefire and the appearance of progress. Why couldn't the president have acted sooner? And doesn't this reinforce the belief of the Arab nations that the U.S. could have stopped the fighting in Israel any time it wanted to?
Bill, I think the discussions that were ongoing over a period of 5 or 6 weeks were very sensitive. They were delicate discussions that Ambassador Habib was having. And it was the president's feeling that to go public with the requests that he was making of the Israeli government could have been counterproductive.
But
nevertheless, his private messages were very strongly worded, and I think that he went public at the appropriate time.
But Bill, how do you avoid the appearance, or how do you avoid the obvious? The Arabs have always believed, and you know it, that the U.S., by a word to Israel, could stop it. And now we appear to have done that.
You avoid that by making the point that I just made, which is that during the course of our private discussions with the Israelis, we were likewise making these points in a forceful and resolute and determined manner.
So it wasn't until you went public that you were able to get a workable ceasefire.
Well, I think that's an assumption one could draw. But
the whole question here has been that there's been a really appalling loss of life, and the moderate Arab nations and other people have been saying that if the president spoke out publicly, that loss of life could be ended. Aren't you confirming, in fact, that if he'd had done that earlier,
what they were saying, Lou, was if the United States would resort to sanctions, that loss of life could be ended. And they were pointing at things like that rather than simply whether or not the president went public. They were talking about different things.
Is there any detail, anything new that we should know about the Israeli harassment of American helicopters and American military liaison teams? Do we know why they did it?
No, I do not. I'm not aware of why. And there's nothing new that I'm aware of.
Let me turn you another direction.
Sure.
And get you off the hook, so to speak. This coming week, the Europeans seem likely to violate what we think is American law about providing pipeline equipment to the Soviet Union. Will the administration invoke the law and punish our European allies if one of the heads of one of those corporations should be in the United States? Will we arrest him for breaking the law?
I can't answer that because I really don't know. I can tell you that the president is still of the view that the sanctions were required and are required, and they remain his policy.
When do you make up your mind as to whether or not to invoke the legal punishments available to you?
I'm sure that that process is ongoing now, probably in the bureaucracy, and I'm simply not aware of it.
Well, can you say whether the U.S. will enforce this vigorously? Because if it doesn't, aren't we sending a signal that this will be quietly forgotten?
The president is not does not intend to send such a signal, and the president's position has been and continues to be that he will enforce the sanctions which he has ordered.
The question is, how vigorously?
Vigorously.
On this program some weeks ago, you talked about being happy or reasonably happy if you didn't lose more than 38 House seats. How many House seats do you think you're going to lose now? And if I can ask to expand that question, how many governorships do you think the Republicans are going to lose in this election?
Well, I don't think I predicted the loss of 37 seats, Lou, as some have suggested. But let me say this, that while we're not making any wild claims of victory, we're not conceding anything either. We think that we may do better, in fact, than some people think, because we have recruited during the course of last year. The Republican Party recruited a number of good candidates for the House. We've got a lot of superb candidates, in fact, and we've got some committees that are very well financed, well organized and well financed. So we think we might do a lot better than people expect. Now, governorships are going to be tougher because we have a lot of governors retiring, particularly Midwest governors. I can't give you, again, any numbers. We're going to make an effort to retain the governorships of some big state, in some big states, Texas, Illinois. We're hopeful in California. We think we got a shot in Florida, so I really can't give you any numbers. But it would be reasonable, I suppose, to assume that we're going to have a tougher time with governors since more Republican governors retired.
How many House seats do you personally think you're going to lose now, Kim?
I will not play the numbers game with you, Lou. I'm sorry.
Once burned, twice shy.
Right.
Let me just go back and ask you what you think in this election the issue is going to be. In the sense, what I'm specifically getting at is it used to be a note of wisdom that political parties are decreasing in importance in elections and it's more local issues, local candidates. Now, President Reagan's presidency seems to have awakened some interest in political party. How do you think it's going to go this time?
Did you say what will the fundamental issue be?
What will the fundamental issue be and how important will party be?
Well, I think party will be important. I think that the fundamental issue in this election is do we stay on course, or do we return to the failed policies of the past? Because really, there's no alternative out there. You've got two plans on the table. One of these plans has been tried for 30 years, and another has been tried for 18 months at most, really less than that. So the fundamental issue in these campaigns, I think, is going to be, do we stay on course, or do we return to the failed policies of the past?
How much is the conservative split in the Republican Party going to hurt you at the polls? The conservatives are ganging up on you particularly.
I would not think, as the president's characterized this as a legitimate disagreement. We don't think it's a, and we certainly hope and believe that it's not a permanent rupture. We would like to think that that if you disagree with the president 10% of the time, but you agree with him 90, you don't leave him just because of that 10% disagreement.
Well, why shouldn't those folks feel somewhat betrayed? Ronald Reagan stood for the things that they stand for many years.
Well, Ronald Reagan still does stand for those things. He has not turned his back on his philosophy, nor has he changed course. This is not...
Well, they would argue that.
Well, that's correct, but I think the point is, as I indicated earlier, there's a lot of misinformation out there about this bill. In first place, it's tax reform. Second place, it's not the largest tax increase in history. The president is still committed to tax decreases, and he's giving the American people the biggest tax decrease in history, $306 billion over 3 years.
Since you managed to get back to that, let me get back to this. A year ago, inside the administration, there was talk, a lot of it from you, about the possibility of a cut in the defense budget of $20 billion. Now, can we get back to that? Are we going to be able to look at cutting the defense budget again?
The president has indicated about 6 weeks ago that that he wants the Defense Department to use as planning guidance the numbers that were in his February budget for 84 and 85, which would indicate no reduction in the level of defense spending. That's correct. The president is committed to rebuilding America's defenses. That was another plank of his platform that he certainly has.
That means the cuts are going to have to come out of entitlements, doesn't it?
It doesn't necessarily mean that, Lou. It means we're going to have to, during the normal budget process, the president also said, by the way, in connection with that, that he reserved the right to review that in the normal budget process.
Meaning it could go higher.
And what he is saying is that he's going to sit down in the normal budget process in September 1984, in September 83, looking at the fiscal 84 budget and make these kind of decisions that you're asking me about today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baker, for being our guest today on Face the Nation.